Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Indiana today will become the 23rd state in the country to be a right-to-work state. It has been a long and heated debate in that state, and it is something that other states have been watching closely because there are other states that would like to also have right to work. In Maine, some leaders are pushing for a similar measure. In Missouri, a bill calling for a statewide vote on a right to work provision has been advanced by a Senate committee. Question here is, you know, just the name right to work makes you wonder what exactly this means. So our conversation this hour will include a little bit of labor history and the great variation in opinions on whether this is good for business, whether it is bad for business. Some have called it a union busting legislation. Is there any validity to that, or are unions asking for so many monetary demands that it makes it impossible for businesses to flourish in the states that have right to work? And why do we use that phrase, right to work? Well, we have a lot to talk about this hour. Our guest is Professor Anne Hodges, professor of law at the University of Richmond. Teaching and research interests focus on labor and employment law, feminist legal theory, and nonprofit organizations. Her most recent scholarly publications explore public sector labor and employment law, the intersections of labor and employment law, alternative dispute resolution, and workplace privacy. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have a lot of calls on this. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Professor Anne Hodges, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. There's a lot to figure out in this, just starting with what we call this right-to-work law. I know that even saying that is controversial to some people. Where did we get this phrase, right-to-work?
Well, this is a term that has been used for many years. The authorization for these laws was actually put into place in 1947 as a part of amendments to the National Labor Relations Act. The National Labor Relations Act allows employers and unions to negotiate agreements that require employees who are covered by the union contract to pay the costs of representation. But this particular provision was put into the law to allow states to opt out of that provision of the federal law. And those opponents of the union security agreements, that's what these agreements are called. The opponents of those agreements sort of coined this phrase, the right to work, and the idea is that you can work without paying any sort of dues or economic payment to the union. Right to work laws are often confused with the doctrine of employment at will, which means that's kind of the background law in most states, that you can quit a job for any reason or be fired for a job for any reason. And there's a lot of confusion as between those and a lot of confusion about right to work, because people often think it gives them some right to a job, and in fact that is not the case.
Yeah, it's just it doesn't have the right name, no doubt about that. Is it fair to say that it would ban union shops where dues and membership are conditions of employment?
Yes, generally, although the law does not allow membership to be a condition of employment. That is, employment cannot be conditioned on actually joining and becoming a full member of the union. It can only be conditioned on payment of the costs of representation, the cost of negotiating collective bargaining agreements and administering collective bargaining agreements. Any expenses over and above that cannot be charged to individuals who object to payment of other fees charged by the union.
Mm-hmm. There are now, this will happen in Indiana today, there are now 23 states that have right-to-work legislation. What has been behind this? Who has been spearheading this effort, and why are states wanting to go or call themselves right-to-work states?
Well, there are a couple of organizations, the National Right to Work Committee and the National Right to Work Foundation, that are based in Springfield, Virginia. And those two groups have done a lot of work in this regard, both in representation, legal representation of individuals who do not want to pay the costs and fees of union representation, and also in campaigning for this legislation, right-to-work legislation. These are organizations that are very well-funded. They have budgets in the millions of dollars per year, and they have been working very hard on this issue for a long period of time. Generally, it is the Republican Party, more conservative political groups that support this legislation. It is a pro-business kind of legislation. It aids business, and businesses are significant funders of the Republican Party, and I believe of these organizations, National Right to Work organizations, because if they can avoid unionization of their workplace, they can, in most cases, reduce their cost. Unions do tend to raise wages and benefits, although a lot of information suggests that union workplaces are also more productive as a general rule.
What I have read, I don't know, several studies have said that the wage reduction is anywhere from 6 to 8% when a state becomes right to work.
There are a lot of studies out there, and a lot of them have conflicting results. Most of them are funded by organizations on one side or the other of this issue. And a lot of them also don't look very specifically at comparative jobs, for example. And also a lot of them don't look at the other factors that influence wage rates and unionization rates and wage growth, job growth. These are a lot of claims about what a right to work law does for economic growth or what a right to work law does for wages. But a lot of the studies are not very carefully done and don't control for other sorts of factors.
I see. It has been 10 years since we had a state go right to work. Oklahoma, I understand, was the last. Why is this movement afoot again? I would imagine it's going to pass, if it hasn't already, in Indiana in the Senate today. Why is it, after being dormant for so long, resurfacing?
Well, I think there are several reasons. The 2010 elections swept a lot of Republicans into power in state and local governments. A lot of folks would point to the organization ALEC, which is an organization that has drafted a lot of laws that are supported by Republicans and conservatives, and has there are a lot of legislative members who are members of ALEC and who are pushing for legislation, much of which is in opposition to unions and favorable to business. So I think that's part of a trend in governments across the country. We're seeing it in other ways, in legislation dealing with collective bargaining in the public sector. We saw a lot of that last spring.
Yes, we did.
So I think it's part of that same general trend. One of the things that's happening in business, of course, is that globalization has made it more difficult for businesses to compete. And so businesses are looking for ways to reduce costs Mm-hmm. And if they can reduce unionization, they can reduce costs. I believe another factor is that Democrats tend to be supported by unions. Unions are strong supporters of the Democratic Party, give a lot of money, a lot of feet on the ground to the Democratic Party, and to the extent that Republicans can weaken unions, then they weaken really one of the last large institutional supporters of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's quite true. And what has happened in the states that have gone right to work? Has there been a almost complete disappearance of unions, or are there unions, but what they do is pretty limited?
There are still unions in right to work states. I am, as you noted earlier, from Virginia, and Virginia is a right to work state. Union density is lower in right-to-work states as a general rule, but unions are still active. When a right-to-work law passes, unions do lose membership typically because there are people who are paying union dues who decide not to when a right-to-work law is passed. So there typically is some loss of membership, loss of union density, but unions are still active in those states. It is more difficult for unions if they do not get payment from all of the workers that they represent, because they are required by law to represent all of the workers in the bargaining unit, whether mm-hmm. they are members or not, whether they pay dues or not, whether they pay the cost of representation or not. So the resources that the union gets have to be spread among all of the workers in the bargaining unit, even though not all of the workers pay for representation. They get the benefits of representation, so it makes it more difficult for the union to succeed and to get higher wages and benefits and win cases on behalf of members who are fired unjustly, for example. And so it weakens the union.
We go to phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. We have a number of people who would like to speak to this issue. Our guest this hour is Professor Ann Hodges. She's a professor of law at the University of Richmond, where she teaches courses in labor law, labor relations and disputes, and alternative dispute resolution, employment discrimination, and the list goes on, employment law as well. We're talking about the right to work. It's a bill that the Indiana Senate will take a final vote on today, and it's going to pass in Indiana. It will become the 23rd state in the country to pass such legislation. So we thought we would get some information here about why this has been so controversial in Indiana, including legislators, Democratic legislators, walking out of the state and going to Illinois for some time to keep this from being debated in Indiana. What has happened to employment, to unions, as a result of states becoming right to work? What's the history of right to work? And we welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls. Rick in Milwaukee. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Rick. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Firstly, I would like to state that in the previous century, I think the main detriment to the union movement in America has been various attacks on it instigated by the Democrat Party. And I can think of probably half a dozen of these instances, but we'll see how far I can take this. I remember back in the 1950s, it was the Kennedy family of Hyannis that had a very strong alliance with Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin, you know, in their anti-communism. But that spilled over into the union movement because Bobby Kennedy, after he was the staff counsel for Joe McCarthy in the Army hearings, then he did the same thing for Senator Estes Kefauver in the investigations of organized labor in America. They pretty much branded American unions as either being dominated by communists or criminals, and that was way, way over-painting the problem. Then what happened during the Vietnam War, George Meany, who was the president of the AFL-CIO, was a very strong supporter of the war policies in Vietnam, so the Democrat liberals again attacked the labor movement in general. And then affirmative action came along after the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That was another opportunity for American liberals to attack the labor union.
All right, we got to stop with the history at this moment. Have Democrats been at the forefront of attacking labor unions, Professor Hodges?
Well, I wouldn't say they've been at the forefront, but I think Rick is right in identifying a number of occasions where Democrats have attacked labor unions for various reasons. Despite that, I think labor still tends to be Democratic and supports the Democratic Party. Some people have advocated that labor start its own labor party, which happened in, of course, many places in Europe and other developed countries, but has not happened in the United States. But certainly there is a relationship, a somewhat mixed relationship between labor and the Democratic Party.
Well, it was an outgrowth of the progressives, and much of it here in Wisconsin, wasn't it? The labor movement.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Rick, for your call. John in Grand Rapids. Hi.
Hi, I listening to your conversation, I was wondering, and it seems to be at least my experience, that a lot of the states that have right-to-work laws are in the South, and I was wondering if you had any explanation for that, if there's some cultural differences between the South and the North, or what your thoughts were about that.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I think that is true, and I do think that a part of it is due to cultural differences. A more individualistic orientation, paternalistic history in terms of the relationship between management and workers. I think that is a very strong factor. I think also racial politics has played a part in it as well, and often in the South, labor unions were portrayed by politicians and by management as sympathetic to the civil rights movement, as favoring integration, and that, too, has been an issue in the South. There is definitely more of a culture of anti-unionism in the South.
Thank you.
Thank you, John, for the call. Gary in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I think in general what's happened, I don't know how far back maybe it goes, but I think the moneyed people have kind of gradually figured out better ways to exert their dominance over the rest of us.
The moneyed people?
Yes.
Professor Hodges?
And when you say better ways, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think they've kind of learned how to use their money with the mass media to kind of get the rest of us to go along with what they really want.
Well, I certainly would not disagree with that. I think the campaigns for things like the right to work law convince people that it's important for the economy. It will create jobs, just as one example, and so and media portrayals of unions are certainly quite negative often, and unions are not perfect like any other organization. There are problems in unions as there are problems in business and corporations, but in the media it has been portrayed as a problem with all unions, whereas when you see a problem with a particular business, it's not typically generalized to, you know, there's a problem with business as a whole. And so I do think media portrayals and media advertising and media campaigns have an influence on this, and of course those with more money can buy more airtime and more media space.
what we're hearing in Indiana, and it goes beyond this, but I think the basic message that we're hearing from lawmakers, and they are Republican lawmakers in Indiana, is that this is a bill that we, and we've talked about this earlier, that is good for business. It will attract businesses, entice new businesses to move to Indiana. Is there a history that that will happen? Do you think that that will happen in Indiana?
Well, the data on Oklahoma shows that, in fact, that has not happened in Oklahoma. And that's probably the most relevant data since it's the closest in time to today in terms of a state that has gone from a non-right-to-work state to a right-to-work state. And in particular, they have not had an increase in manufacturing. Manufacturing often tends to be the target for this because, one, manufacturing is more unionized than other industries, and two, manufacturing is mobile. Service industries, in a lot of respects, are not as mobile as manufacturing. So I don't think the data from Oklahoma supports the fact that there will be a significant increase in business and jobs in a state that passes a right-to-work law.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Elaine in Appleton, hi.
I'm looking for your opinion on some of this. Shouldn't that be labeled the right to work for less pay? And then, of course, there's only, I believe, it's only 8% of the working population belongs to a union, so they really don't have that much influence with the or money to put into the Democratic Party. And I think where they have exit interviews when employees leave their employment, companies right away find out that whether how their people are being treated at work. When they have an exit interview, they find out why they are leaving, and that has a great deal of influence in how they operate their business.
What is the percentage, starting with the first point, of people who are in unions now?
It is about 8% in the private sector. It's much, much higher in the public sector. It's about 36-37% in the public sector. The data just came out for last year, and I believe there was a little bit of an uptick in private sector unionization, an increase in union members in the private sector, but it's still around 8%+. So it is quite low compared to the public sector and compared to what it used to be. Mm-hmm. At its peak, it was around 35-36% in the private sector, and that was back in the 1950s. So it is true that unions do have less money, less power today. They still do have some money and some power, and a lot of feet on the ground. Union members do a lot of work in political campaigns. And, of course, there is the public sector piece of it, which is part of why I think we saw these attacks in the public sector last spring, that that's the most unionized sector in the country today. And so we saw those attacks. In terms of the right to work for less, that's certainly what a lot of supporters of labor have called the right to work laws. I think the supporters of these laws have captured the terms of the debate by denominating this the right to work and making it appear as if it is a benefit to workers. Because if you talk to people, particularly in areas like the South, they think it gives them some right to work. I mean, they really don't understand what the law is. Mm.
So it really needs another name. Do you have suggestions?
I don't know that I have a suggestion right off the top of my head. I'll have to think about that one.
Okay. In Indiana, this has been debated, and there have been so many disagreements about this. Democratic legislators have left the state of Indiana, going to Illinois to keep the bill from being discussed. There has been some criticism about the amount of effort that has gone in on the part of unions actually to spend less energy in Indiana and to redirect their efforts to places like Wisconsin or Michigan, where their unions are stronger and have a little bit more political clout, perhaps.
Well, obviously unions have to make strategic decisions about where to deploy their resources, and I certainly don't have any inside information about this, but my guess would be that stopping sort of the first state in 10 years from passing the right-to-work law perhaps might have been a priority. And certainly there's a long history of unionization in Indiana. It's not a state like the southern states where unionization has historically been low, although union membership has dropped in Indiana over the last, I think, 20 years or so. I actually worked in Indiana for a brief period of time some years ago, and it was a pretty highly unionized state back in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Elaine, thanks so much for your call. We go next to Matthew in Madison. Hi, Matthew.
Yes. Hi, I have a question regarding the right-to-work law. I'm assuming that the federal law states that union contracts have to cover all employees regardless of whether they pay for that representation or not. And are these right-to-work laws in states, do they vary in whether they require, even if people choose not to join a union, if they require those people to pay for representation, do some states not require that payment at all? And if so, are there any is there any move to lessen that federal requirement of unions covering all workers?
I have not seen any sort of movement to lessen that requirement. It is a requirement of federal law. Under federal law, unions have to represent all of the workers in the bargaining unit, whether they are members or not, whether they pay dues or not. The state laws all say, essentially, they cannot require you to pay any sort of dues or fees to the union. So the laws may have some very slight variations, but generally they're pretty uniform. And they do allow employees to escape paying for the cost. Now, years ago, when the law was first passed in the 1940s, it was interpreted to allow unions and employers to negotiate these agreements to require employees to be members of the union. But over time, the interpretation of that changed out of a concern for forcing an association. It's a concern about the Constitution, the constitutional right to freedom of association, and a concern for forcing employees to be members of an organization that they did not want to be members of. So over time, the interpretation changed, and the requirement became one of only paying for the costs of representation. And so that's what these laws in the state say. You can't negotiate an agreement that requires payment. There could be a change in federal law that says unions only represent their own members, and they do not represent and are not required to represent other individuals in the workplace. The reason that there is a requirement to represent everybody, I think, was a notion that it's difficult from the point of view of an employer to have different terms and conditions
right.
of employment for some employees than others.
Thanks, Matthew, very much for the call. And we have, isn't this ironic, another Matthew from Lodi. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, good morning. I think you touched on the main topic as to why it's called right to work. I had several uncles that worked for a large national food processor, and they were members of the union. And when they had some disputes with employment, the union essentially ignored them. And over the years, it became obvious that they were paying union dues for essentially no reason. And I think when you look at that, if I, as a young worker, want to go work for X corporation or the government, if there's a unionized job in the government, and I don't want anything to do with the union, either A, because I'm Republican, I see most of the money being spent for political purposes for the Democrats, or I don't see any benefit, I should have that option. I think it should be exactly like you just said. The people that would like to be members of the union should be allowed to, and those that do not want to be members shouldn't be forced to pay any type of dues whatsoever. And that's, I think, where right to work comes from. You don't have to be forced to pay dues to get a job.
Professor Hodges.
Well, I mean, as the law is now, at least in a state with one of these laws, of course, you don't have to pay. But again, the union has a duty to represent everyone. Now, they may not do that very effectively in some cases. Obviously, I don't know the situation that happened with your uncles. Some unions are more effective than others. Unions do provide some rights to employees that they don't have without a union. But again, the law does require them to represent everyone and to do that without discrimination or hostility. They obviously don't win every case. In some cases, an employee may have a complaint that is not covered by a collective bargaining agreement. The collective bargaining agreement is the agreement that sets the rights of the employees, and the union has to make decisions about what conduct by the employer violates that and what cases to pursue, because they do have limited resources. Their resources only come from the dues and fees that are paid by the employees. As for the political piece of it, the employees who are paying only the cost of representation, as long as they object, the money that they pay to the union cannot be used for political causes. They have a right to object, to pay only for the cost of representation, and to prevent their funds from being used mm-hmm. for any sort of political purpose. So that is a right that exists under the law, even where there is an agreement that requires them to pay dues and fees. They cannot be required to pay for any money that goes, for example, to the Democratic Party or to any political purpose like that.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that's not always made clear. I was reading about this Indiana case, and there's a quote from Mark Mix, president of the National Right to Work Committee, who has said that many union members do not approve of the politicking associated with organized labor, and they should have the right to withdraw their dues in protest. From what you're saying, they do have the right to withdraw some of their dues in protest.
They have the right to withdraw any portion of their dues that's used for purposes that are not germane to the purposes of collective bargaining. Now, that is not true if they are a member of the union. If they choose to join the union, then they have to pay the dues, and their dues are used by the union for various purposes. But they do not have to join the union. They can be essentially a fee-paying member, if you want to call it. That's not really a member. They just pay the cost of representation. If they do that, then none of the money that they pay can be used for these political purposes. So it is a choice in a sense. I mean, if you choose to be a union member, which you can't be required to do, then they can use those dues for other purposes, but you can't be legally required to be a full union member.
I see. Thank you, Matthew, for the call. Tom in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question. I guess it's a two-part question. First of all, is it true that unions, where they have a strong market share for the work, such as in trade work or manufacturing, is it true that they raised the overall wage scale for that work in that market? And also, if you remove this factor, if you say the unions are going to have a smaller market share or they're going to be weakened in the market, what is the overall impact in the local or regional economy? Is there any empirical study or any information that supports or responds to this question one way or another?
Yes, I think unions do, where they have a larger market share, tend to raise wages in that particular labor market. And the reason for that is the competition. And even those employers who are not union, if they want to get the best workers and avoid being union, they will raise their wages in accordance with the wages negotiated by the union. So it does tend to raise wages in a particular labor market. And that is one of the goals of unions, because to the extent that other employers pay lower wages that are competitive with the unionized employers, it makes it more difficult for the union to negotiate higher wages with the employers that they have a contract with. As unions lose market share and as wages go down, it does become more difficult for unions to negotiate those higher wages. So wages tend to go down in the particular economic market. You know, one of the difficulties that unions have faced in recent years is the move of much manufacturing overseas and the lower cost of wages in third world countries where employers are moving to manufacture at lower rates, and that makes it more difficult for unions to negotiate higher wages in the United States.
Right. Thank you, Tom, for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest is Professor Ann Hodges, professor of law at the University of Richmond. The Indiana Senate, we've been following the news on this, is today going to be taking their final vote. This has been debated for over a year now on the so-called right-to-work bill, for want of a better name for that. If it passes, Indiana becomes the 23rd state in the nation to pass such legislation, and legislators in places like Maine and Michigan are looking at what happens in Indiana very closely because they would like to see similar legislation introduced in their states. We're talking about what this bill means. What does it mean to be a right-to-work state? What does it mean for unions? What does it mean for business? And our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, more of them. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick comment and question. My comment is, I'd sooner live in a right-to-work state and get paid $10, $12 an hour for a job than not have a job at all. And regarding collective bargaining, that's my question. We have three companies here, Harley-Davidson, American Marine, and Sub-Zero. They have great unions. They have collective bargaining. They keep asking their workers to take 20% pay cuts. What is the point of having collective bargaining? That's my question, Professor Hodges, to you, because it just seems our state is in an uproar because the governor stopped collective bargaining with public employees. And for private employees, I just don't see there's much of a point to it anymore. So that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think that is some evidence of what we were just talking about earlier. That is, it has become more difficult for businesses to be competitive in the global economy and pay higher wages. And where these businesses are having economic difficulties, what they do is come to their unions and ask for reductions in pay and benefits. To the question of whether there is some value, I would say that obviously, I mean, that's up to the individual workers to make that decision, to decide whether they want a union to represent them. One of the things that a union does give workers is a voice at work. And an organization that provides that sort of voice, which can be more powerful than an individual voice. Another thing that is typically negotiated as a part of a collective bargaining agreement is a requirement that employers have just cause to terminate a worker. That's protection that very few workers in the private sector have without a union. It's virtually non-existent without a union, except for the state of Montana, which has a law that requires just cause for termination. Otherwise, generally, employers can terminate workers for any reason or no reason at all, except for some discrimination laws that, that limit the ability to terminate someone because of their race or gender. So the just cause protection, I think, is a protection that unions typically negotiate that isn't seen outside of union contracts in the private sector.
Do you think, the caller brings up an interesting point, and when you hear that the reason for people introducing right to work is they want businesses to flourish and they want to entice businesses, but when you mentioned one of the big problems here is that a lot of businesses are just moving offshore and they're taking advantage of people in places like China and paying them absolutely nothing in horrible conditions, some of the companies. When does the focus shift to the responsibility of the businesses to be able to come back here and pay people enough here so that they can live on their salaries and not put the whole burden on, well, it's high cost, that the workers, it's the unions, et cetera? I mean, isn't it everybody who needs to sit at the table together and figure out what it is that will allow companies to be able to make a decent profit, workers to be able to make a decent wage, and work from Indiana or Wisconsin or wherever?
Well, I think you highlight an important point, and that is this is a political issue for the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question about what sort of limitations we want to put on business, how we want business to function. I mean, from the business point of view, their goal is to make money for their shareholders, and it's not to provide the best place to work for workers. It's to make the most money that they possibly can for the owners. And, I mean, it's hard to fault them for doing that. That's what they're charged with doing. That's what they're employed to do. And so if they can make more money by moving overseas, then that's what they'll do because that's their goal. If we as a country decide that we don't want businesses to be able to do that, that we want them to take other goals into account, then we have to do that in some way. We could do it by law. We could do it by consumer power, for example, buying goods that are made in the United States. We're starting to see a little bit of that. Businesses that are marketing the fact that their product is made in the United States. Because we're a consumer-based economy, a huge part of our gross domestic product is consumer spending. And if consumers don't have money to spend, then our economy is going to be in trouble.
Right.
So we need to focus on that as a country, I believe.
Yeah. Marie in Bayview, hi.
Hi there. Now I have so much to talk about that I can't possibly talk about at all.
Well, pick something, Marie.
Well, pick the fact that I think that it is Republicans and business are aligned and that they'll do anything to race the rest of us to the bottom. And I know that their business has the fact that they're supposed to make money for their stockholders, but don't you think that there should be some responsibility to their employees? And I particularly think that it's not what the United States stands for to basically just about have slave labor in another country. I thought we were supposed to be showing the way of democracy and not trying to just take advantage of people in other countries, and then that drives us to just take advantage of our own workers.
Well, I think that's the question, and I think it's a question that we as a country have to answer. What kind of a country do we want to be? What do we want our laws to do? That was part of the reason for the passage of the National Labor Relations Act back in 1935, was to give workers the right to come together and to deal with their employer as a group, because they were relatively powerless without that. And that's why unionization came about and grew. But we've moved in the other direction now, and unionization is shrinking. And I think it's a matter for the country to decide, you know, what do we want? What kind of country do we want to be? That's a very good question. And it is the question.
Well, it is the question. So let's just start answering it. Let's answer that question. What kind of country do we want to be? Marie, thank you. Brad, hi.
Hi there. Without union representation, what you'll see is the United States worker reach an equilibrium with the Chinese worker. Their pay will come up a little bit, and our workers' pay, benefits, and working conditions will go down a lot. And I think with younger workers especially, I don't think that they fully appreciate what working conditions, pay, and benefits were like in the not-so-good old days 100 years ago when unions were first forming, and they don't appreciate everything that unions have won for them. Could the guest talk a little bit about what unions have achieved for workers in America?
Well, it is very hard to see if you're a young person, and I think unions have not done the most effective job of educating workers about unions and what they do and about the history of unionization. It's certainly something that's not taught very often in the schools. I've recently been reading The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, and I would recommend that to anyone who wants to learn about what conditions were like 100 years ago in factories and workplaces where people were injured, where once they were injured because of unsafe conditions in the workplace, they were simply put out on the street and left for their families to take care of or left to die because they were unable to work any longer. We didn't have workers' compensation laws that provided benefits for folks, and the conditions were unsafe. People worked long, long hours, you know, 12, 15 hours a day, 60, 70, 80 hours a week was not uncommon. 6 and 7 day work weeks at very low wages. Before the 1930s, we didn't have a minimum wage. And during the Depression, people underbid each other all the time. And employers hired women and even children, like 8, 9, 10-year-old children, because they could pay them less money than they had to pay the male workers. So those are the kinds of things that were in place before we had stronger laws and before we had unionization.
Thank you very much for the call, Brad. Let's go next to Joel in La Crosse. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to keep in mind that 100 years ago, the corporations were owned by a very few. And if you look at the Chinese problem, they're revisiting what our history has taught us about why we need unions. But I'd like to bring up the point of the unions seem to have lost their way. You know, where they used to be really caring about the worker, once the state granted them a monopoly, they started playing the political game, and people aren't really all that encouraged about needing the union. They see it more as a political function rather than somebody that's there protecting their rights and helping them negotiate the best contract that they can.
I do think that unions have, as they have grown, they have become more bureaucratic organizations. They've become larger, perhaps further away from the needs of the individual worker. I think unions became very complacent in the latter part of the 20th century. And in part, some of that complacency, I think, did come from the ability to collect dues through union security agreements, and from the lack of a need to do significant organizing. If you look at unions in a place like Virginia, they're not very complacent because they don't have some of those protections. And some people have argued that right-to-work laws might be actually beneficial to unions because they force them to do more organizing, more servicing of the workers. So that's another side of the argument. I do think that if people are dissatisfied with their unions, one of the things that is required is that unions have elections for officers. I think it's every 3 years by law they have to have these elections. And so what a union is a collection of workers. And if the workers really want the union to do something different, then they need to get involved in the union and make it theirs.
And we're saying goodbye to you at this point. Thank you so much for the hour. It was very interesting. Thanks. Professor Ann Hodges, professor of law at the University of Richmond, talking about what will happen in Indiana today. It will become a right-to-work state. Tomorrow, during this hour, we'll talk about leadership. Where is the leadership we need to solve some of the pressing questions that came up this hour? What do we want America to be? We will talk about that during our 10 o'clock show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for all her production work this hour.